June 13th, 2019. We have six cases on our calendar today, three of which are oral and three are non-oral. The first case on the calendar today is State B. Antonio Franzione Jenkins Sr. Council will each have 15 minutes for their argument, followed by 5 minutes of rebuttal for appellant. You can proceed when you're ready. I'll ask that you please identify yourself and the party you represent, and the podium is adjustable if need be.
Thank you, Your Honor, and good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Anders Erickson, and I represent the appellant in this matter, Antonio Jenkins. Mr. Jenkins is requesting that this court reverse his convictions and remand for a new trial based on the victim's recantation of his identification of Mr. Jenkins as the shooter, along with the prosecutor's misconduct throughout Mr. Jenkins' trial. The narrow finding that we are challenging is the post-conviction court's determination that Hammock Wade's trial testimony was not false, and similarly that Hammock Wade's recantation was not genuine. This court can reverse the post-conviction court's finding only if it determines that the court abused its discretion. And this is the unique case where the record establishes that the post-conviction court did in fact abuse its discretion when it denied Mr. Jenkins' petition. The post-conviction court's finding that Hammock Wade's recantation was not genuine was clearly erroneous. In other words, the court's finding was contrary to the weight of the evidence and not reasonably supported by the evidence as a whole. When reviewing the evidence as a whole, I think it's very important for this court to acknowledge that the recantation was very narrow. It's not that he did not believe that Mr. Jenkins was the shooter. It was only that he did not see him pull the trigger, and he did not see, was not able to identify him that morning. So it's not this broader recantation that nothing was true or that it couldn't have been Mr. Jenkins or that he should be fully exonerated of the allegations. This is important for three reasons. First, I think if Mr. Hammock Wade was truly pressured to lie, it would have been a bigger lie. It would have been Mr. Jenkins was not there. He didn't do it. It was somebody else. I know it wasn't him.
So which parts of his trial testimony are not recanted? Or what facts to which he testified at trial remain?
His original identification of when the officer first asked him who shot you, all he said was tone. And I think that aligns with what he is saying now. Thought it was him. But
that came in at trial through an officer, didn't it?
An officer testified to that, but he also admitted that he told the officer okay. That, I believe.
He testified at trial that he saw Tone walk toward him, and he started to get out of the car and said something like, you know, hi, Tone, or what's up, Tone, right?
Yep.
So does that remain or not?
No. That is part of the recantation. That's actually the base of the recantation, is that never took place. That a man walked up to him, he was able to say that he was wearing a gray hoodie and had dreadlocks, but the extent of actually interacting with Mr. Jenkins and knowing it was him at the scene, that is what is recanted, and that is what a jury would have to decide if his recantation would result in not being able to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that it was him that was at the scene.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
In the district court's review in determining whether the recantation was genuine, do you agree that it was proper for the district court to consider the circumstances surrounding the recantation?
I think it was absolutely proper to consider the phone calls and everything else that took place, given this unique situation of two people being housed next to each other at the St. Cloud prison. Where I think the court erred was it never analyzed the actual veracity of the affidavit. The court focused entirely on this letter that was sent prior to the affidavit being signed, and that has never been the basis for the recantation, this letter with a different handwriting. We don't know anything about that. That's not part of our argument. We did not file that. That is something that the state obtained and filed that to somehow cut at our argument. But the court...
Isn't that evidence of the circumstances that led up to the recantation? Isn't that relevant?
I think it's relevant, but we don't really know much about it, right? We don't know who actually wrote that.
But you got the burden of proof here, so not knowing much about it doesn't help you much.
Well, not that's the state's evidence, right? So we...
You have to prove it was false at the time it was testified to.
We submitted a sworn affidavit that Hammock Wade signed that said that his testimony that he identified Mr. Jenkins as the shooter was false. Mm-hmm. That is a sworn statement. We know who signed it. We know there was a notary there. There's no doubt about what that said. This letter that was sent a couple months earlier that we don't know the circumstance surrounding, that the state presented at the post-conviction hearing, we don't have a burden to refute that. I mean, that's the state's evidence trying to say that this affidavit was somehow not the truth. And I think we meet our burden by just filing the affidavit, because that is the only sworn testimony we have regarding whether or not he recanted.
But I thought you earlier recognized that it's appropriate for the court to consider the circumstances surrounding the recantation to determine whether it's genuine. So how does the... Isn't that inconsistent with your argument that the affidavit itself meets your burden?
Well, I think the court can absolutely consider it, but the state's evidence, we can go through it. I mean, the phone calls between Mr. Hammock Wade and his wife, those don't establish, those aren't sworn statements. The first phone call was prior to Mr. Hammock Wade signing the affidavit, and in that phone call, he never alleges any threats or anything. The whole phone conversation is that Mr. Jenkins is being nice to him. He came into his cell, and that he was giving him canteen and all that sort of thing.
Didn't he also say that he apologized to him?
He did, and I think that this court, you know, that is the evidence that the state has presented. But I think that was previous. Well, I know it was previous to the affidavit being signed, and I think him lying in that phone call to his wife is consistent with him lying at the trial. That was before he signed the affidavit.
But when we're talking credibility here, isn't that something we defer to the trial court? The trial court saying he was credible at trial, he's not credible in this affidavit, and that's my finding. And given the circumstances, isn't that well within the trial court's discretion?
Well, this definitely is a unique case in that we don't have live testimony regarding the post-conviction evidence, right? So this court can look at the transcripts, and I urge the court to listen to the audio of Hammock Wade's phone calls with his wife, because I think the tone of their voice and the arguments and his wife actually yelling at him to not testify is pretty persuasive. But back to your point, I don't think it's a case where we give great deference to the trial court or the post-conviction court, because there wasn't live testimony. It's not like the post-conviction court was watching the witness and could consider the credibility of a witness testifying, because that just didn't take place.
But it did take place at trial with his original testimony.
That's correct.
And Judge Redding was the trial judge, right?
Yep. And Judge Redding absolutely at the trial was able to consider Hammock Wade's demeanor and his testimony at that time, but everything changed when he signed that affidavit, and there's no sworn statement subsequent to that that counters or cuts at our argument that that is the truth.
What is the value of the affidavit in light of the fact that the affiant refused to testify at the evidentiary hearing? I mean, he refused to make himself available to cross-examination. Mm-hmm. I mean, in other words, must the post-conviction court take this at face value, or can the district court, the post-conviction court, discount the affidavit based on all the circumstances which Judge Cochran referred to, and based on the fact that he doesn't want to take the witness stand to be subject to cross-examination?
Yeah, I think there are two parts there. The first is we stipulated that all of this evidence would come in, and that Judge Redding, as the post-conviction court, could consider it all.
The exhibits.
Could consider the veracity of the affidavit based on all of those exhibits. We agreed that he would come, that if he were to testify, he would show up and he would plead the Fifth. There's nothing in the record that establishes why he would plead the Fifth, if it's because of the threat of perjury.
Well, the Fifth Amendment, I think it's self-evident, right?
Absolutely, but I don't think that cuts against us to say that he would somehow testify differently than his affidavit. You know, if he were testifying in accord with his affidavit, the state could charge him with perjury because that is different.
How do we know that he would? I mean, if he were to, you know, to testify, I guess it's hard to know exactly what he would say.
That's true. I mean, he's vacillated quite a bit from his trial testimony and the phone calls and the and also in the affidavit. So we don't know what he would testify.
But I guess maybe my original point of my question was, I believe Chapter 590 says that the post-conviction court may consider affidavits. I don't think that the post-conviction court must consider affidavits or must consider them in the same manner as live testimony. But, I mean, I think your argument essentially depends upon the premise that the post-conviction court was required to take that affidavit at face value.
Well, so there were evidentiary issues regarding the phone calls, the recordings, what the admissibility of those, along with the affidavit. And we stipulated that all of that evidence would come in and the court would consider all of it in making its determination. So there's no different evidentiary value to the affidavit, except in our opinion, we believe that it's stronger because it is a sworn statement. But as far as whether or not it has lesser value because of the post-conviction statute, we all agree that it would come in and it would be evaluated just like any other sworn testimony. And there was no argument by the state that the court could not consider it as a sworn affidavit. I would also like to acknowledge that within the post-conviction court's order, although this isn't a separate issue, the court never stated that it was a preponderance of the evidence standard. And I think that's important because we don't know what weight the court gave or what standard it required Mr. Jenkins to meet when determining whether these statements were true or false. And I think that's very important because if the court held Mr. Jenkins to a higher standard, then that would result in the findings in which it reached that Mr. Jenkins did not meet his burden. I would also just like to focus on Mr. Jenkins' phone calls that were also recorded. I don't think those have any persuasive value. I think we have to look at this from a perspective of if he was wrongfully convicted and if the person who testified against him and identified him as the shooter was in a cell next to him, how would he react? Is it reasonable that he would make contact with Mr. Hammack-Wade and try to get him to tell the truth? Absolutely. I don't know why the Department of Corrections put them next to each other, but I don't think that should cut against Mr. Jenkins in any way because he had the right. And I think if you're in prison for, you know, have a 300-month sentence, it's reasonable to try to get the person who put you in prison to tell the truth. And that's all those phone calls establish is that there was contact. Mr. Jenkins never said that he wanted Mr. Hammack-Wade to lie or admitted any wrongdoing at all. It was only that he wanted Mr. Hammack-Wade to tell the truth. And that affidavit is what we put forward as the truth. I would also like to just rest on my brief for the second argument, unless this court has any questions regarding that. I can respond in rebuttal.
One question on the never mind. No, I guess I don't. I thought it was on the last issue, but not really so.
I have a question for you about the booking photo.
Yep.
Comment. Do you agree that nothing in the record indicates that comment was intentionally elicited?
No, there's nothing in the record regarding that. It was just, the prosecutor has the duty to prepare his witness and to make sure that the witness doesn't say exactly what he said in this case. And I think the prosecutor has that duty to do that. And even if it's not intentional, it can still be misconduct.
Is it clear? I had a question about that as well. Is it clear from the officer's testimony that when she's at that stage in her investigation, and I guess I mean the whole of her testimony about her investigation, is it clear that the booking photo that she referred to was not from his arrest in this matter, but rather a prior booking photo?
Yeah, because the investigator, I believe it was before Mr. Jenkins' arrest that he showed the photo to Mr. Hammack-Wade and said, you know, we have this database of booking photos, and that's where the booking photo came from. So I think it's reasonable for the jury to infer that it was a prior case and not necessarily from arresting him in this case when he hasn't yet been identified or arrested.
I guess I had a related question, and I don't know if I have the excerpt right in front of me, but I guess I'm a little bit unclear about which part of the testimony was objected to, because there, I mean, Sergeant Metcalf says, well, I looked at the booking photo for Antonio Francian Jenkins, and then she, I think it's a she, goes further. And then there's another question, and then there's an answer about there's a database we called MRAP, and then there's an objection. Mm-hmm. And I assume that the objectionable testimony was two paragraphs back, not the immediately preceding paragraph. Do you agree?
Yeah, and subsequent to that...
Your argument, is that true or not true?
But. Well, our argument is that the attorney objected to all of that coming in. Any testimony regarding the database, regarding the...
Why would the database be objectionable or prejudicial or erroneous?
Well, I guess not on its own, but when you consider it with the booking photo. And if I could just say one more thing, I know my time's up here.
You may. Go ahead.
Thanks. Subsequent to that, there's a objection and a discussion off the on the record, but away from the jury, where the defense attorney makes a longer argument and pinpoints exactly what it is that is his argument, and the court then rules on the mistrial motion. So that happens subsequent to that, you know, that objection in front of the jury. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, may it please the court. My name is Sean Cahill. I'm here on behalf of the respondent, the state of Minnesota. The state is asking that this court affirm the post-convictions order denying relief to the petitioner, in addition to find that that there was no prosecutorial misconduct, and in the instance of the booking photo, I'll start with that. While I believe that was error, it was certainly harmless. Given that, I'll, with the court's permission, begin with the issues regarding these statements, whether or not they constitute prosecutorial misconduct.
Can you explain why you think it's harmless error?
Thank you. As we pointed out, first of all, this was a brief statement that was made within a larger context of how the investigation proceeded. There was a statement of saying that they did not have essentially have the shooter identified. They went out and were looking for methods to confirm who the victim in this case said, hey, this is Tony. They needed to go verify and identify who that Tony was. In the course of that description, the officer began describing how they would conduct a sequential photo lineup, and which cases she described the process. We go through our MRAP database. We look through, unfortunately, as we mentioned, booking photos to find descriptions that would match the person provided by a witness, or in this case, the victim. She selected those photos and then presented them. That is the context which she did note that she did find a prior booking photo of Antonio Jenkins. She noted that I did, and I believe that's exactly the statement, I found a booking photo of Antonio Jenkins. There was no description about where it came from, the circumstances under which it was derived, how old it was, what the underlying crimes were, any circumstances, or even when it was from. At which point, the officer quickly moved on, did not refer back to it, did not refer back to any of those prior any arrest incidents or any crimes. And she continued by saying, once we made the identification, she continued to testify about how the investigation proceeded. I will note that based on the, in addition to the fact that it wasn't dwelled on, it wasn't brought up, it was simply a description of how the investigation, how they came around to this photograph, upon the objection, the court also gave a curative instruction for the jury to disregard that testimony. So I do think if there is any prejudice, we presume that the curative instruction was followed by the jury and they would disregard that statement. Based on the totality of those circumstances, I'd put forward that the jury certainly is, would not have been, the verdict would not have been impacted by that, particularly in light of the fact that we have several other occasions where the victim is making numerous statements about who shot him. It's Tony, it's Tony. He does eventually identify him. He does essentially give his description within the street name that he knows him by. The question isn't so much of comparing, let's say, is it actually Mr. Jenkins? The victim clearly knew who Mr. Jenkins was, provided testimony of that, and was able to make that identification. Therefore, I think that also bolsters the reliability of the sequential lineup. In other words, it simply it wasn't that he was a complete stranger, but he was able to have some knowledge of this person beforehand. In totality, I think that the evidence, and not just the sequential lineup, clearly shows that they correctly identified the correct person, that the victim in this case, had, Mr. Hammack-Wade, had identified the person who had shot him. And looking at that in total, I think the jury would have been more impacted, certainly by the statements he made as he was lying on the ground, shot, trying to describe to police who shot him. And this was merely an attempt to connect those dots between the identification made by Mr. Hammack-Wade as he was shot lying on the street to an actual legal name and person. Based on that, I think the jury would have found that far more persuasive than, for example, any issues or prejudice that would have been caused by the mention of the fact that in this case, Mr. Jenkins may have been booked at some undisclosed, undescribed prior incident.
How many of the state's witnesses testified to identity?
Your Honor, I believe essentially once the identification was made by Mr. Hammack-Wade, several other officers, including the officer who arrived on scene and the investigator, both testified and that is, in fact, the identification made by Mr. Hammack-Wade. And so there were several instances of it by at least two other witnesses other than Mr. Hammack-Wade describing his identification, his ability to recall and remember who that person was. Granted, there was no one else on scene who could say that he is the person who shot me, but several other officers were able to corroborate and indeed confirm later prior consistent statements that Mr. Hammack gave on the scene. In addition to that, I'd also point to fact, looking at some of the other statements brought up to by the appellant in this case with regard to burden shifting, I believe with regard all of those statements were not burden shifting for the what they were attempts by the state to essentially rebut any of the alibi defense that was raised or essentially credibility determined attacks that they made against Mr. Hammack-Wade. I'll particularly only objected to statement was whether or not there was a lack of evidence supporting whether there was a vehicle in the impound lot and whether or not the photographs were shown Mr. Hammack-Wade. I believe those were essentially offered in a rebuttal argument by the state. These photographs and this discussion about the blue Tahoe were an attempt to attack the credibility of Mr. Hammack-Wade. They're being used as a sword to try and say Mr. Hammack-Wade testified that I observed the person he knew as Tony at some earlier date within that vehicle. Defense tried to rebut that by showing, no, this blue Tahoe was stuck in an impound lot and that could have never happened. With that, in the rebuttal, the state then moved forward saying Mr. Hammack-Wade really didn't have an opportunity to confront or were shown photographs that were actually entered in an exhibit at trial by the defense. So the defense never even confronted Mr. Hammack-Wade with those at trial saying, how could it be fair? He wasn't essentially given the opportunity to comment upon the evidence which the state wants you to believe. That, in that case, is not burden shifting in any way. It's simply offering a rebuttal to what was offered in defense and the evidence offered by the defendant in that case. In addition, I believe there was the statement that if what the defense is going to ask you to believe is that when he's shot lying on the ground that he's about to die, that he's going to make some story that Antonio Jenkins was the one to shoot him. The prosecutor then argued, if you believe that, acquit him. Again, that's not burden shifting. I think that is just simply doubling down and asking to find Mr. Hammack-Wade credible and his testimony credible. They're saying they're acknowledging the burden of proof, saying if you do not believe that Mr. Hammack-Wade, you should acquit him. That's no way attempting to show that the defense has any burden, that the defendant is required to produce any evidence, and simply a comment, if you find the victim credible, you either should convict or you should acquit. With regard to, I'll just rely on the comment that the jury should not be intimidated by the reasonable doubt standard because we've had in the justice system for under 200 years. This was not objected to, but I will note in State versus Martin, they made the comment in State versus Martin that many people are still convicted using this burden. That was found not essentially to be error because it is a correct statement of the burden. And similarly here, there's no inaccurate statement of what the burden is. It's simply an acknowledgement and rebuttal that after the defense had gone through a lengthy explanation of how high that burden is, what's necessary is This essentially is telling the jury, this is also the standard we've been using for 200 years, and in no way misconstrues what the actual burden is. Also knowing the shooting comment, when one human being pulls out a gun in the streets and tries to kill another, all of society are harmed. This was also unobjected to, and again, rely on our analysis using State versus Ferguson. In Ferguson, the prosecutor noted, I'm bringing them in here because those people deserve to be safe in their own neighborhoods. The important part we were looking at that one is, obviously Mr. Hammack Wade was a little bit reluctant to testify. He was dealing with credibility issues, and the prosecutor was attempting to explain his rebuttal, closing argument, about this is not a man necessarily you are going to like. This is not maybe someone who you would agree with. And I think the comments prior to that show that he's really saying this is maybe not someone you agree with, but he still deserves the protection of the law.
But how does the statement, when one human being pulls out a gun on the streets and tries to kill another human being, all of us in society are harmed, how does that go to his reluctance to testify? Having a hard time understanding the connection.
It's really looking at the prosecutor is going to the greater burden, saying is even if this person does not want to be here, even if this person doesn't want to testify, the victim themselves may be hesitant. Crime, or at least the nature of the shooting, puts us all at risk, and I have a duty to uphold the law in this situation. It's essentially more looking to with the motivation of the prosecutor about why they would bring forward this witness and why would this pursue this case. If I may, be anticipating a rebuttal of, well, if the victim isn't here and isn't willing to be very clear about what happened, why should you care? And I think the prosecutor in this would make the effort saying, we care because this is a dangerous situation. This carries a lot of harm that could possibly hurt other people. I think there's also a reasonable inference that you're going around firing off guns in public area or into a car in this case. There's some certain other danger here. I grant it's inartful and probably could have been phrased much better, but I do think ultimately it is not error in the sense where they're trying to broaden about why this is being brought and why the prosecution is pursuing it. With regard, and if I may, turning back to the just post-conviction order in this case, if there's no further questions regarding any of the statements of the alleged prosecutorial misconduct. Thank you. Looking at that, then, I'd ask court again to affirm the post-conviction order. As the court's already noted, this post-conviction court has clearly looked at all the evidence, looked at the totality of circumstances, and I think the narrative speaks for itself. And I do think the calls between Mr. Hammack Wade and his wife paint the picture quite effectively. It's a man who, as the appellant has put it, simply did not lie big enough in order to make it a lie. I put to you that it is a lie just enough to placate a man who's threatening you. And I think that's the narrative that has played out throughout the phone calls, the issues with the DOC, and the letter. So we see that a person who is clearly in a contained situation was placed right next to the man who, in fact, did shoot him, and then was fearful of him and offered as little as he could to get by to placate that person. I will note, as the court considered, Chapter 590 does allow the court to consider affidavits. I agree with Your Honor, that it does not require consideration of the affidavit, but even if you are to take that affidavit on its own value, it is clearly undercut by the totality of other evidence in this case. The phone calls, the fact that there was the letter that was showing that there was two different handwriting styles suggesting that it was drafted by other people, which arguably was also the basis and contained the same content as the affidavit itself. Finally, I note while the court did not comment on whether or not it was going to use the preponderance of the evidence, I do believe it had correctly applied the Larison test. And it did check to whether or not that the court had to be reasonably well satisfied that the testimony given by a material witness is false. I think we're making a little bit of a jump because it was not live testimony, but they were looking at the affidavit of Mr. Hammack Wade. I think it certainly gave that due consideration, considered that in light of all the evidence, and while they couldn't make the in-court analysis, I don't think that necessarily changes anything because, as the justice noted, they did have an opportunity to view Mr. Hammack Wade's trial testimony and weigh that against the words that were being given now in the affidavit. Aaron, with that, further questions, I'd cede the rest of my time.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
To answer Judge Johnson's earlier question regarding how many people were able to testify to identity, it was one, and that was Mr. Hammack Wade. He was the only one who was able to identify Mr. Jenkins as the shooter. All of his other statements were subsequent to that to different investigators, just corroborating his original statement, but there was no other eyewitness testimony, no one else who could put Mr. Jenkins on at the scene.
But the responding officer gave testimony about identity by testifying to what Hammock Wade said as he was lying on the ground, right?
Correct. And what he was saying when he's lying on the ground, like I said, mentioned before, I think that goes along with what his recanted statement is that at that time he believed it was Mr. Jenkins, but when he was lying on the ground, he did not say, Mr. Jenkins came up, I saw him, I said, hey, Tone. None of that came out when he was lying on the ground. I'm not saying he should have said it on the ground when he was in that situation, but it didn't.
But don't we in our rules of evidence give more weight and credibility to a statement that's either an excited utterance or, deathbed statement, which you could almost argue this is a functional equivalent of. So the reliability of that statement is pretty high.
Yeah, and the statement actually did come in as a dying declaration because at that point everyone believed that he was actually going to pass away. But like I just said, that statement is actually consistent with what he said in his affidavit, that he believed it was Mr. Jenkins who shot him, but he just did not identify him. And that's the whole crux of this argument, is that it's a very narrow
issue.
Isn't
that statement that he, I'll look at the affidavit itself, but his statement that he wasn't sure it, that I did not see who shot me on March 19th. I mean, isn't that questionable given the circumstance of the shooting? The person who shot him was very close to him at the time.
Well, the shooting took place, I believe it was 5:30 in the morning in March. It was dark out. The surveillance video shows it was dark out, and then it was just beginning to snow. He was sitting in a car. The position is that he was smoking crack. Someone appeared, reached in the car and shot him. I mean, that's for a jury to decide, and I think the jury could consider his new testimony along with what he testified before and make a determination at a new trial. So whether or not he actually was able to identify him, what he's recanting is that he could not identify him, and he didn't identify him at the scene of the crime.
But in considering whether this affidavit is genuine, whether his recantation is genuine, isn't it fair to consider what he's saying in the affidavit and the circumstances of the shooting?
Absolutely. And this court needs to consider the affidavit along with all the trial testimony and everything else that came in at the post-conviction court.
And isn't that what the district court did in this case?
The court did, and our position is that the court abused its discretion and made clearly erroneous findings by not considering the totality of all the circumstances and all of the facts. The court did not recognize that Mr. Hammock Wade lied multiple times about identity in his trial testimony. The investigators all testify that his whole story regarding this guy, Uncle John, at the Rush City prison and that he got a phone call from Mr. Jenkins was fabricated. Why would he need to lie about that story if he saw Mr. Jenkins shoot him? Why would he need to lie about seeing Mr. Jenkins a few weeks after the shooting at a gas station? There was no purpose of him needing to lie if he identified him at the scene and he could confidently testify that he did see Mr. Jenkins. And the court never considered that in its post-conviction order. It only considered this letter that was sent a couple months before the affidavit was signed and the phone calls. So we believe that in itself is an abuse of discretion and resulted in the clearly erroneous findings. The court doesn't have any other questions. We request that this court reverse Mr. Jenkins' convictions and remand for a new trial. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you to both counsel for your arguments and your briefs. The matter is submitted, and we will issue our opinion within the statutory time frame.